Oi, oi, it's your boy, Slackensy Jack. It's the Jack Slack Boycast, and we're coming at you on Wednesday or Thursday, depending on when I edit this. Like I said earlier in the week, I had a mare of a week, so I only talked about three fights on the Monday podcast. We're going to talk more about some of the UFC lesser hyped fights today. Well, I suppose they're quite hyped within this community. Being on the undercard doesn't prevent people from losing their shit over you. And we'll catch up on some of the stuff from one Friday night fights, eight, which is, you know, or seven, whichever one it is. But it's not a great way to get people hype for your fights. Call it what it is. Call it Irsel versus Sinsamut 2 or whatever. Because there were some bangers on that. Not in the MMA sphere, but in the Muay Thai sphere. And then, of course, we've got some fights coming up this weekend that we'll talk about. Honestly, though, don't get your hopes up. Not an amazing round of fights. With the exception of the main event, Marlon Vera versus Corey Sandhagen, which is a real contrast of extremes in style. So before we get into it, let's talk about UFC 286. I did all the Usman Edwards stuff. Had some hilarious comments about that. There are some people who are absolutely convinced that Usman was actually the more offensive fighter and should win because of that, even though he was landing at something like 40%. And the amazing stat to take away from it was that Leon Edwards landed more than 40 strikes more than Usman and threw more than 40 strikes less than Usman. So it doesn't get much more of a contrast in accuracy and effectiveness than that. But people are like, oh, you've got to count aggression. And you're like, if you're massively outscoring someone and not missing, striking and going backwards, and stuffing 80% of their takedowns, I think you're probably winning. The insanity of Daniel Cormier portraying it like they're even on the feet. And then someone said, well, a lot of Edwards' strikes were body strikes, and you've got to consider that. And you're like, how? How have I got to consider that? Because people think that, like, living with long-term brain damage is more fun than living with long-term liver damage or rib damage or whatever. Or less fun, rather. So yes, we did all that. We did Gaethje Fiziev, which was a great fight. We did Gunnar Nelson versus Brian Barberena. We skipped Maia versus O'Neill, and I still haven't watched it, because why would I? Vittori versus Dolidze was, you know. So we're talking like real undercard shit now. Mohamed Makhachev versus Jafel Filho. I'd seen Filho's last fight. Was that his last fight? Yeah, on the Contender Series. And I was not blown away by him. I thought he was very mid, and that this fight was another sort of fluffing of Makhachev's dick on public television. But Makhachev, beautiful shots, beautiful takedown attempts, threw some kicks, threw some punches, actually did some stuff this time, struck from top position. Still, he's got a very strange style where it's kind of like what you used to see from Khamzat back in the day, and I suspect you'll still see it if he gets away from the cage now. Amazing at controlling people along the cage, not very good at controlling people out in the open. Not good at, like, traditional positional control. But Filho, to his credit, really scrambly guy, and I really enjoyed his scrambles. I had heard about the manky-ass knee bar coming into this fight, and I thought it was about to happen when he got taken down and used a single butterfly, to elevate Makhachev overhead, which is when he can start entering the legs. And then he didn't. He tried to scramble up off it instead. And the actual knee bar, I never saw that coming, because it was Makhachev took him down again, sort of was on his feet, not on his knees. You know, he hadn't dropped onto Filho yet. And Filho had a space to invert very, very quickly underneath him and catch the knee bar attempt. It was really impressive. And my boy, I believe from the old Bloody Elbow days, TP Grant, who does a lot of grappling stuff on Twitter, he put up a thing just saying, you know, it was a clip of the knee bar being hyperextended and saying that you need to be breaking legs. You know, you need to be training to break legs. You can't be waiting for people to tap, because they will let you destroy their leg. I've seen people, like, let other people break their limbs in amateur fights. That's insane, because it's kind of like finding out how good your chin is. If you're doing it at, like, the amateur level, you're not going to be good enough to pursue a full career. You know, it's not, you're wasting valuable resources that should only be tested in world title fights or fights where there's thousands of dollars on the line on fights that you know, I'd say they're, you're fighting for free, but in the case of amateurs, because of all the paying for training and shit, you've actually paid to be there. But yeah, Makhachev let this man, you know, I was going to say was going to let this man break his leg, but he did let this man ruin his leg. I don't know the details of how badly it's mangled, but he is going to have to take some time off to get it fixed or fix it, whether that's surgical or rehab or whatever, because he's just taken time off for a mangled shoulder. Nibar's a weird one. It's got a special place in my heart. I used to love watching Minoru Suzuki. I believe he had the record for a while. It was him and Oleg Taktarov used to get Nibars all the time. And of course, it's a big thing in Sambo because the Nibar, the heel hook is not legal in, I believe, most Sambo competition. But the saddle, the position from which we get the inside heel hook most of the time, is a big part of Sambo. So they love backstepping on Nibars. They love rolling through on Nibars. And it, yeah, it's got that fantastic Sambo heritage. You watch Volk Han back in the day, who I'm always talking about, but like he was an early sort of Sambo in MMA guy and a big pro wrestler in Japan. And very, you know, from Dagestan, so very important in the development of mixed martial arts and also coached people like Fedor and Sergei Haritanov. Real revered guy in Russian martial arts. But he used to do what's called the victor roll in MMA fights. He'd roll through on the legs, give the guy the back body lock and roll through on their legs to look for the knee bar. Claudio Pulez is another guy who's in the UFC and he's knee barred three people now. Unfortunately, his striking was absolutely embarrassing in his last fight because Dan Hooker, he was like 1990s jiu-jitsu guy. Or Matt Serra's brother, you know, wouldn't come out of the butt scoot. but the knee bar, you don't see it so much nowadays, but you do see it in different sort of occasions, particularly off heel hooks. You know, if you watch Huzumar Palhares' fights, he's known for the heel hook, but a lot of the time what he gets people with is what I think the Danaher crew called it a heel bar. But you have the heel hook grip, they turn, and you just extend your hips through their knee. Ones you can watch right now where he did that. John Fitch. I think the Mike Pierce one was a heel hook. Dave Branch was a heel hook to knee bar. And then in grappling, his entire run at ADCC, Dan Schoen, David Avalan, and Rafael Lovato Jr., you know, who was a world-class, all-time great grappler, got them all with the heel hook to the knee bar. And then there's guys doing stuff from the full sweep now. When you're in the full sweep, which is a weird leg-locking position that you might as well just look up, me telling you about it isn't going to do any good. But when squirming in the full sweep or trying to turn in the full sweep, the opponent's leg could be knee-barred not only over your hips, but your forearm, which is underneath, which is like, imagine your forearm between your belly and their knee. It's bad. It blows out people's knees real quick. Diego Pato murdered some dude from here. Look up Diego Pato full sweep knee bar because you'll find a video of it on YouTube, I'm sure. But the thing about that is that those knee bars that you're seeing nowadays tend to be follow-ups to other attacks, rotational attacks, heel hooks, where the guy straightens his leg and turns, and then you extend his hips over you extend his knee over your hips. Going for the knee bar is quite blatant, and what you saw in this one was that he got the knee bar, and I'm not saying it didn't work because he fucked up the guy's leg, but Makhachev was able to keep using his free leg to kick Filio's hands further up his leg, which in one regard is like you're putting him further on the, you're putting the arm further up the lever, which could be really bad. But in another way, he's slipping control. It was always looking like the crook of his bicep was just coming off the end of the leg. And in the course of kicking the grip away, he was able to slip his knee out from between Filio's thighs. And then, you know, Filio had a little crank on it just to see if there was anything there. Because I've seen guys get it, especially if you're wearing a cup, if the knee gets like into your taint, you can still put some force on it. But he decided it was gone and then tried to start scrambling up. And Makhachev, to his massive credit, you know, because immediately I was watching him to see how he moved. He did move slower. You could see his leg was hurting, but he went through all the moves just the same. He wasn't doing anything to take the weight off his leg. He just ran through this guy, took him down, got on his back, got the choke. And he is being hyped by the UFC. They are trying their hardest. He's in these fights where he's kind of struggling with guys like Malcolm Gordon, who I don't hold in great esteem as a fighter. He's struggling with the grappling elements, which is really weird because he's mainly a grappler, and he's also like not really throwing strikes from top position. So there's a lot of, I think, justified criticism of Makhachev, but his performance here, not only the beautiful takedowns, which I absolutely loved, shooting and immediately turning to the back, classic flyweight shit, and this is flyweight, but guys shooting and turning to the back as the guy's sprawling. You know, we had Jucia Formiga was amazing at that for years. Brandon Moreno's great at it. Alejandro Pantoja and now Makhachev. But all of that was brilliant. And then just to tough through that knee bar, which, again, at this level, is it worth it? But it is half your money lost if you lose. And he did finish, so he probably got a bonus. Hang on, I'm going to check. He did not get a bonus. Fuck, that's rough. But, you know, it's not great to be doing that at this level. Even, you know, it's the very beginnings of his UFC run. I suppose he's three fights in now, but he got the win. That's the most important thing for moving his career on. But I feel like if he'd lost this one, he could have very easily put together another two or three fight win streak and been in title conversation. It's all a question of whether the damage is lasting. And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes people get their ACL, MCL, and the other CL severed and come back like nothing's changed. And sometimes people are out for 2 years with blown out ACLs, like Kid Yamamoto is a great example. Went out for 2 years with blown out ACL, just never recovered. On the subject of knee injuries, that Christian Leroy Duncan, Dusko Todorovic fight was kind of let down because I was quite enjoying how it was starting. Christian Leroy Duncan, maybe I've seen him on a Cage Warriors. Cage Rage was the really grimy one. Maybe I've seen him on Cage Warriors, but I was looking at him in this one with fresh eyes, untainted by actually remembering him. And I was pretty impressed with what he was doing. His movement was nice. His stance switches, attempted a spinning kick near the fence and then pulled it because he was like, oh, he's going the other way. Moved in, hit him with a good 1-2 along the fence. Yeah, he was looking fine. And then he got the clinch. They started jostling for position. And as Dusko Todorovic stepped around to catch himself, he jarred his knee sideways and then immediately just dropped to his back because he'd fucked his knee. Bit of a letdown. I was quite enjoying that one. In terms of quick finishes, actually, Jake Hadley versus Malcolm Gordon was impressive because I joked about this one beforehand. Jake Hadley getting a fighter who can grapple. Never a good sign for him because Nascimento bodied him. But, he hit Malcolm Gordon with a southpaw left uppercut to the body, the old Gervonta Davis special. In the ring, that is. You know, generally, that could mean, like, beating your wife. But, left uppercut to the body. The Zab Judah special. And put Gordon down very quickly. Then got given the microphone in the interview. And Jesus Christ, never give this man a microphone again. They were like, and you want to call out Muhammad Makhachev? And he's just like, hello, my name's Jake Hadley. He's a big pie eater. And he best be hoping not to fight me. And whoever was doing the interview just had a look of, for fuck's sake, Jake. charisma. They don't train that in the gyms. But I was impressed by him, so I won't be too harsh on him. That was a really nice performance. The Ryan Murphy versus Gabriel Santos. Is this the last one we're going to talk about? Actually, no, we'll talk about Yanal Ashmov versus Sam Patterson. Oi, oi, it's Yanal Ashmov. Sam Patterson, very, very tall, long guy. We're all going, oh, Ashmov's going to have trouble getting in. And then just as Patterson throws his first or second low kick to the thigh, Ashmov steps in and hammers him in the face. He went for an overhand, but didn't catch him, but off-balanced him and then hit him with a left hook on the way down. That's the thing about stepping in on the right low kick. Fedor used to do it all the time. Igor Vovchanchin used to do it all the time. If you do it, they'll fall over. And if you hit them and they fall over, that's seen by a lot of people as a knockdown. Seen by Big John McCarthy as a knockdown if you punch them in the chest as they're on one leg. But yeah, this one, I was just watching this and thinking, man, you know, we don't talk about, obviously, being taller and longer than an opponent is an enormous advantage in a striking context. But it does make it harder to throw the calf kick because that's a kick that's like at an extreme low angle to begin with. If you're fighting someone your own height, you're throwing it, you know, below the knee. But if you're fighting someone shorter than you and you're doing it from further out, you're throwing a really weird kick, brushing along the floor. Drastically shorter than you, that is. Something I never experienced being 5'2". Yeah, Leroy Murphy versus Gabriel Santos. I was really pleasantly surprised by Gabriel Santos. Didn't expect a lot out of him. I do enjoy Leroy Murphy. He's never looked as good as a 12-0 record suggests, or 12-0-1, whatever. You know, he's never looked like a world beater, but then neither did Leon Edwards. He just gradually got better, and I was going, man, he might be the best UK fighter, and then he wins a world title. Yeah, he hasn't looked unstoppable. He had Ricardo Ramos could have beaten him if he hadn't been focused on throwing Rabona kicks. He had a terrible round against Amokani, but then everyone does. And in this one, they went pretty even. I mean, as reflected by the scorecards, but it was a split decision for Lorraine Murphy. Really like what Santos was doing. Murphy was the switch hitter. Santos was just standing southpaw. But every time Murphy switched, he threw the left body kick as hard as he could. Always what you want to be doing against switch hitters. Wait for the switch, hit them with the big bomb when they switch stances, and then their head's not quite caught up defensively with where they are. But Murphy was hitting with good 1-2s. So really nice knees to the body out of both, actually. Santos's takedowns look nice. Murphy's grappling looked nice. Actually, on this card, there were a couple of really nice transitions that I liked from the bottom. And when I say transition, I mean, it's kind of like, it goes back to what we're always talking about, because I'm always talking about the giggler or the knee lever or whatever you want to call it, because I love it. But it's an off balance. And if the guy can't catch himself, it's a sweep. And that's the general rule with everything. So treat it as an off balance. And if they fall over, fucking fantastic. But if they don't, you're moving on to the next thing. And you literally saw that in Leon Edwards versus Kamaru Usman. I think it was Jose Aldo put it up on Twitter. And I retweeted it, so go have a look at it. But it was that half guard sequence we were talking about. He's in half guard. And I said, and he pummels in the butterfly hook, and then he gets up from there. But he doesn't just pummel in the butterfly hook. He stamps on the floor next to Usman's knee, does a little knee lever, and then in the process of Usman changing his balance and putting his knee further out, or you know, hopping his knee over to base out, the foot that was trying to block his leg comes in for the butterfly hook, and then he goes into butterfly hook work. So yeah, that's one example of it. But Jai Herbert, who's a teammate of Leon Edwards, also did one in the first round. Just a little one to bring the guy over the top of him and then insert butterfly hooks and start getting up. They're real small moves, and you don't notice them because the guy doesn't like fall over like when Mansoor Barnoui does it. But in this one, there was a really nice one. Leroy Murphy was in the bottom of closed guard against Gabriel Santos. And he grabbed with two hands, one of Santos's hands, lifted it up, ducked underneath it, and put his arm up behind the guy's back in what's called the octopus underhook or the reverse underhook. You'll see, the B team call it the reach around for obvious reasons. But it's a really useful position, and it's catching on a lot. And in the 10 seconds that Khabib Nurmagomedov spent on the bottom in the UFC, he immediately went to the octopus guard because it makes scrambles really well. So what you're doing is you're leaning, you're ducking your head underneath their elbow, and then you're bringing your elbow up their back. So you've both got your head and shoulders behind the other guy's elbow, and you're in that weird wrestling position. I've heard it called a cat dog position. I think Lachlan Giles called it that. But I've liked this for years. I mean, Tellez used to do it back in the day, the Turtle Master. BJ Penn did it to Matt Hughes and got on his back. And then people claimed that he blew out his rib doing it. It's like, no, he blew out his rib when Matt Hughes hit him with like 10 elbows to the body from guard. It wasn't his move that blew out his own rib. Oh, he'd have been unbeatable if it weren't for himself. The only man who can beat BJ Penn is himself. But he did it successfully. But the way that a lot of people use it now is as a... to force a reaction, not to like wrestle up with the octopus underhook, but to force the guy to bring his arm back in, to overreact, to go into a defensive posture. So what you do is you lift their arm up, duck in behind it, get up on your elbow like you're going to start doing octopus scrambles, and the guy will whip his elbow back in front of you so that he's like hugging your face to try and cross-face you back down. Gary Tonin used to do this. He'd go octopus guard, the guy would whip his hand over the top to try and stop Gary, and then he'd grab the Kimura and rip it out because the guy's hand would be on its own. It wouldn't be both hands together. He'd have one hand coming back, and Gary would rip it out and throw it up his back. He did it to Zach Maxwell, son of Steve Maxwell, and he also did it to Buchecha, who you will know is a 250-pound monster, and Gary Tonin is like 5'2". You can find that match on YouTube. Actually, maybe he didn't use the octopus setup on that, but he likes his half-guard Kimura. So he So that is one where he hits it. But he did do it against Zach Maxwell. But in this Murphy versus Santos fight, he sits up for the octopus underhook, gets up on his elbow. Santos brings his arm back over in front of Lerone Murphy's face. And Lerone Murphy just puts the other hand back to the floor as well. And he's up on his hands and scoots his butt back towards the fence. The classic Dustin Poirier move. Get up on your hands and move your butt back towards the fence. And then he gets up along the fence and is up by the end of the round. Unfortunately, it was the last round. But yeah, it was a really good move. And that's what I'm talking about when I say transitions on the bottom. Because, you know, you get caught up with like, he's got to throw a triangle. He's got to sweep him. But no, you just got to do, you got to threaten things to create further action in the direction that you want it to go. Whether that's getting up out in the open with butterfly hooks, or whether that's getting up along the fence, or whether that's getting up with an underhook and starting to wrestle. So that was banger. And then the other stuff that I liked this weekend was on one fight night, whatever it was. Main event was Regian Ersel versus Sinsemert. We talked about this a little bit last time. First fight, Ersel was doing nicely, countering Klinmi's left body kicks. You know, parrying them across the body and then trying to enter afterwards. And in the later rounds, his jab got to work really well for him. This one, he fought much less conservatively. He just went out and started jabbing Klinmi's face off. Anytime they got near the ropes, Ersel jabbed him back and jumped him with a flying knee. Klinmi was throwing up kicks and stuff, but it's kind of like something I saw the other day. It was one of the Crush cards or Rise cards. I think it was Rise. Philip Kimura fought some Thai who used to be a stadium champion, but is now like a really old man. And then there was Ryusei, I think it is, the guy that they're touting as like the next Tenshin Nasukawa. He fought another Thai who I also think was a stadium champion at one point. But both the Thais did some really weird decision-making. They wanted to not punch, you know, they were both fighting big bangers, fast-handed lads, and they both wanted to use kicks and move. But they both came out and immediately threw like a round kick to the leg, without using their hands to frame or anything. And if you're just throwing round kicks at someone who wants to step in on you, you know, you might hurt them, but you don't have a barrier to stop them coming up the middle. So your kick could land perfectly and then you still get hit with a left hook, like the guy who fought Philip Kimura did, got knocked out very quickly. Whereas if you put your hands out straight and frame on the guy, you've got stuff to stop him stepping in on you. It was a really weird way to fight. And since it was sort of fighting like that in this one too, you know, if you want to deal with someone's punches by throwing round kicks and not push kicks and straight kicks to keep them out, you need to have something barring their entrance up the center. Because getting hit on one leg is the disaster scenario. Or you need to time it really well. You know, if you're going to throw like nice low kicks and then retreat and throw counter left hooks going backwards, you really got to get a read on the guy's footwork and pace. And doing that in the first round is a bit sketchy. But anyway, Klinmi ended up getting knocked out by a beautiful left hook to the body. Really lovely stuff. If you watch it, Ersel, he steps in, he stabs his left foot in, turns his toes in, and he just throws a real short, digging left hook to the body, left uppercut, you know, shovel hook, whatever you want to call it. Elbow in, tight left hook. And it reminds you how much hip rotation you can get just by putting your foot in side on as opposed to straight on. Really lovely punch. Knocked him down, immediately out. Sitzimut was not getting up. He's just laying on the floor going, ow. So yeah, really nice. And that makes Ersel... Oh, he was already both Muay Thai and kickboxing champion in one. But very cool. And this was apparently on World or National Muay Thai Day in Thailand, which I suppose is the only National Muay Thai Day that matters. But the top three fights were 4-ounce Muay Thai. I think most of the fights were 4-ounce Muay Thai. But it was interesting because Sylvie, who I think won like a WBC, they made a title light enough for her to compete for. But Sylvie Douglas-Monito, I think she's got over 200 fights now, but she does this amazing Muay Thai library. If you've checked my Patreon, the only thing that I'm subscribed to, Muay Thai library, where she talks to old boys and you know, obviously there's, because it's not a huge money sport, there are a lot of guys win Lumpini Stadium titles, they'll win Fighter of the Year, they'll impress enormously in their day, and then they'll just go on to have like a later career as a taxi driver or something like that. And it's, you know, it's not like, because there is so little money in it, it's not seen as a great shame, as in, you know, you're not an embarrassment for doing that. It's just how normal people's lives go. It's kind of like, you know, being a decent college athlete. You know, there's so many American salesmen who are like, oh yeah, I was a pretty good baseball player back in the day or whatever. Donald Trump was a baseball player at school or whatever it was. It's only weird to us because we think that, like, if you're the best in fighting sports, you should be making billions of dollars and making it rain everywhere you go. But so she has all these wonderful old boys that you haven't heard of, or if you have heard of, you're like, oh, damn, what are they up to? And, you know, famous guys like Diesel Noy and Sam Art and so on, teaching her, you know, just doing like a training session with her or several. And she was talking to Wang Chenoy, who is a multiple-time, I believe, Lumpini champion in different divisions. And he trains fighters now, and he was very worried about four-ounce Muay Thai. He said he had two fighters he'd been very badly injured by getting knocked out with four-ounce gloves in one. And it was interesting because every time I watch these four-ounce Muay Thai fights, I notice that they're getting hit more with and hurt more with jabs and short left hooks and things. Because so much of Muay Thai is framing and smothering people, and I think the big gloves get in the way a lot of short punches. It's not, I don't believe that people hit considerably harder with 4 ounce gloves. Every test they do on those shitty sports science programs seems to say that when you're trying to punch hard, the bigger object makes you punch harder, the weight of the bigger object. But I don't think there's any denying that punches slip through easier with 4 ounce gloves. And certainly when you watch someone like Nong O fight, his jab has looked so much sharper in his one fights than in any of his traditional Muay Thai fights that I've seen. And I think that's true of a lot of people. Their boxing just looks a lot sharper and more dangerous. Same on this card was just landing his left straight constantly. Muang Thai in the co-main event hurt the guy with just a short... He hit him with a low kick and then he faded away and hit him with a short jab as the guy came onto him, and that hurt him. And the guy had been taking big elbows and things up to that point, absolutely fine. So I think it's because things sneak through easier, and there is also all this stuff to do with, like, you know, it's the ones that you don't see that hurt you, but I also wonder if that affects what causes concussions and things like that, whether being ready for a blow, whether it's a subconscious clenching of muscles, or whether it's genuinely... whether it's something to do with your brain not being ready for it that makes things worse. But, yeah, I read that, and then I was watching these fights, and it was really interesting because the thing that I am always noticing with 4 ounce Muay Thai is how much more important it makes boxing, which is interesting because so many great Nak Muay have gone on to be great boxers anyway. You know, the boxing work that they do does prepare them well for a boxing career. It's just that it seems to be a more damaging weapon for them in 4 ounce gloves. Don't know if I'm telling anyone anything new or interesting there. It's just my musings combined with that Wang Chenoy quote from this week. But your co-main event between Muang Thai and Kulab Dan was banging. These guys had fought 3 times before, I believe, in Thailand. And they had the Moreno-Figueiredo split. It was one each, 1-1 and a draw. With Kulab Dan winning the most recent fight by knockout. I always love Muang Thai. The general consensus is that he's losing a step. I mean, he's 28, which is young, but it's not young when you've been fighting forever. He's got nearly 300 fights. Had that banger against Liam Harrison where he got knocked out. But then he's on a 3-fight winning streak at the moment. But this was just gorgeous. Rather than just being the elbow zombie, because he can get sometimes a bit fixated on the elbows, he used his kicks very well in this fight, I thought. He's got a very interesting teep. Lead leg, push kick. You know, you can watch someone like Sanshai, someone who's famous for their lead leg push kick, or Boakao, you know, and they have really lovely form. And it's like they're expanding into the kick. And when the push is happening, when they contact the opponent, everything is in line beautifully. And they're just in a really strong posture. If you took a photo of them landing the teep, you'd go, oh yeah, everything there is a beautiful structure. There's no way the opponent's pushing back in on that. And Muang Thai, in this fight, well, his teep generally, is he looks like someone trying to kick themselves in the head. He's all bent over and his knees right up in his chest, and then he's trying to teep from really close in. I mean, it sort of works. He was knocking Kulab Dam off balance a lot with it, but it is strange to watch. Everyone in Muay Thai uses their teep at some point, but you know, when you watch people who are noted for it, and then you watch someone who just sort of does it in between stuff, it's very noticeable how weird his form is. But yeah, he started this fight needling Kulab Dan with kicks. Kulab Dan stepped in the late first round and he smashed him with a gigantic left elbow. And the sense that you got was Kulab Dan was a much more explosive guy than Muay Thai. And it was looking like, oh dear, am I about to see my boy get knocked out again? Second round, Muay Thai comes out and he's doing some beautiful clinch entries. It was one that I really liked where he threw a low kick, but it was a calf kick. It was below the knee because Kulab Dan picked his leg up, checked. So it was just shin on shin, low down, which is never as bad as, you know, the bottom of your shin against the top of their shin. But it's a shin on shin, ankle on ankle connection. And Muay Thai hits him with the kick, just steps it. He puts his foot straight down underneath Kulab Dan's foot. So immediately it's awkward when Kulab Dan's foot comes down. And then he steps into the clinch. Really beautiful. So he goes from southpaw, they're both southpaw. He goes left low kick onto the check, puts the foot down, steps into a clinch, and starts elbowing him. And the elbows were lovely. You know, they're always lovely with Muay Thai, but sometimes he's throwing them like punches from out in the open, and sometimes he's doing little choppy ones from the clinch, and those were the ones that he was eating him up with here. Just getting the bicep tie, and then, like, he's running his hand through his own hair, but the elbow goes across the guy's face at the same time. Started to chop Kulab Dan up with those, and then in the third round, he stepped in with one, and it was classic Muay Thai, because that's what he was doing in the stadiums a lot, stepping in with elbows, which are short weapons to begin with. You know, like, I'm always saying in MMA, like, why are you stepping in, lunging after the guy with elbows? Why are you running at them with elbows? You should be in range and then throw the elbow. But Muay Thai does do it. And sometimes he gets away with it. A lot of the time he gets away with it. And he does it with his head, like, whipped back at the ceiling, too. It's everything you're looking at, and you're going, that's terrible form. And Kulab Dan was throwing an elbow back at the same time. And you're just watching the replay going, well, you could have got, but you got yours instead. And the power he gets on these elbows. Because a lot of the thing is with elbows is that it's an ungloved surface, it's a big hard surface, and they tend to connect from very close range where people don't see him coming. But he's throwing them like a punch from out of range. And guys just go stiff. It's incredible. I suppose because there's so little give. You're doing it, it's one bone, basically, from the point of the elbow down to your shoulder. It's just your, fuck, I don't know what that's called in your arm. The equivalent of the femur of your arm. You know, it's just one bone. There's not a lot of give, where if you hit someone with your fist, there's give in the contact point even. You've got a ridiculous amount of bones in your hand. Your hand acts like a bag full of gravel, just moving around while you're smashing it into someone. Then you've got your wrist, and so many guys give at the wrist a little bit anyway. Half the reason that a lot of guys don't like punching the bag bare knuckle, or no wraps rather, is that they hurt their wrists in the process. Especially uppercuts. Oh my God, I remember as a young man, wailing on a bag. It was one of those wall shield things with like a poppy out top bit. And, you know, I hadn't seen a lot of those at the time. The bags with a shelf bit so that you could throw uppercuts at them. You know, it was always using like a bigger maze bag at about head height and throwing uppercuts against that. And I threw this uppercut against it and my wrist just buckled in on itself. And I've been doing, no hand wraps bag work for years at that point. It was also kind of low, the bag, too. It was too low for what I would, if I were fighting someone my size. So I threw it at a really awkward angle and fucked up my wrist for a couple of weeks. Which may have been the beginning of my fucked up wrist guillotine. I think this was years before I started grappling, even though, to be honest. But the injuries that I saved up striking, I've definitely used a lot in grappling or irritated a lot. So yes, I think that's where the tremendous power, because it's crazy when you're watching it. It doesn't make sense that he's hitting that hard when there's so little movement behind it. But it's his full body weight, and he's turning his shoulders and hips into it, and there isn't any give at all. It's like being poked in the head with it's like a pneumatic ram hitting him in the head. There's no give. So can't recommend watching that enough. Beautiful, beautiful fight, to be honest. Kulab Dan was taking it to him in the first round. A beautiful knockout by what is becoming an old boy. I mean, he is only 28. I would call him a kid if I met him in any other context. But old man Muay Thai terms, Muay Thai. And then the other one was Sam A versus Ireland's Ryan Sheehan. And, you know, when we're talking about old men of Muay Thai, Sam A has over 400 fights. I think he's ticking closer to 500. You know, he's 39 years old. He's been doing this forever. And it was interesting watching this one because Ryan Sheehan, it looked like he'd maybe watched the Haggerty fight or something like that, because Haggerty, his like breakout performance was he was a guy with 9 fights on the British scene, and then he fought Samme in one and took him apart. And what he was doing was beautiful lead leg kicking. He was picking up his lead leg as if to teep, and then he'd drop it to the floor, switch kick. Then he'd drop it to the floor in a switch kick into the lead leg. He'd switch and then he'd throw a teep. You know, it was this constant switching up of lead leg kicks. And he had Samme in this awkward out of distance, trying to pick up your leg to check things, trying to parry kicks, never really getting into what he wanted to do. And Sheehan came out and immediately started throwing teeps to the lead thigh, orthodox versus southpaw. He's orthodox, Samme's southpaw. He starts throwing teeps to the lead thigh, but he just does like 4 in a row. No mix-ups, no confusing him. And Samme reaches down with his hand, slaps the knee across from this teep, and slides down the side with the left straight and booms him. And that was the story of the fight. He was just landing this left straight non-stop. And again, this is the 4 rounds Muay Thai, probably. He's got a good left straight anyway. I'm not going to say he doesn't. But if you watch a lot of Muay Thai, particularly the southpaws, they love the left straight to the body because you can get it in. Left straights to the head land much less frequently when both guys are reaching out, trying to hand fight, check the other guy's hands, frame off him, pull him in. But Samme just couldn't miss with his left straight here. Sheehan kept going back to this teep to the lead leg, and Samme would just reach down, swat it across with his lead hand and punch him. And then he was doing great things like he did a little bounce back. He circled off and stepped away, and as Sheehan came forward, he bounced off his back foot and went straight into the left straight again, boomed him. It's a really great showing for left straights. It's a really great showing for Samme. It's nice. It's always nice to see an elder statesman of Muay Thai pick up a win. And as Brian Sheehan had just won like the ISKA European title in his division or something like that, so he's not a bad fighter. He just got boomed. So those were the 3 fights that I really liked from that one card. Let's talk about the fights this weekend, because I don't have super strong opinions on any of them really, except for this main event. I was going to talk about one Friday night fights that's coming up tomorrow night, but in the course of me recording this, that Rod Tang's pulled out from his fight with Superlek. People accusing Rod Tang of ducking. You know, Rod Tang does not seem like the type of dude to duck, but he has had a lot of issues going to fights recently. But then someone was showing me his seminar schedule in the US, and he's going, oh yeah, that doesn't look like a guy who's taking things super seriously. But that's the thing, like if you're ducking someone, don't sign the bout agreement. That's how ducking's done. If you sign the agreement and then they make a main event of a card around you, you're really, if that's really what you're doing, you are alienating promoters in that process. And then the only really notable thing happening on that card aside from that is Seohi Ham is fighting Itsuki Hirata in a fight that will make good thumbnails for the one intern. This is the horniest man in MMA, folks. I mean, Itsuki Hirata, no lies, good-looking girl, and posts a lot of pictures of her in, you know, sports bra and short shorts with absolutely chiseled abs. But there's a disconnect between, like, the Instagram of a fighter and you as the promotion advertising her fights. They'll have, like, her opponent in their fight gear with their fists up on the picture, and they'll have Itsuki Hirata in her pants weighing in. Going like, whoa, steady on, guys. But this is kind of her biggest opponent yet. You know, she's got quite a young career still. She's 5-1. And Seohi Ham has been around forever. She's got, like, a 30-fight record. You know, people enjoyed her going to the UFC. She was kind of too small to be in the UFC. It was assumed that she'd be, like, the greatest ever. You know, outside the UFC as an atomweight. But then she had that fight with Denise Zambawanga, great name, where they gave her the decision, but Denise Zambawanga should have won. But then they did a rematch and she won. So, you know, that's good. But she's on a winning streak going back to mid-2017, you know. Not amazing names in there, Miyu Yamamoto, Jinyu Frey. But then who is an amazing name in that weight class? I suppose Ayaka Hamasaki, who she beat in Ryzen. But she's all right, Hamdele, and she has the freshest gear in women's MMA. They really dress her out nicely because she's got, like, proper sponsors. I remember her turning up in Ryzen and she had, like, Nike, and they specially designed all her gear and stuff. And that's what everyone should look like. They should have their own sponsors and they should have their designs on it. But, yeah, I talk about this all the time. Anyway, the UFC card. The thing I should probably be talking about this week but haven't because it's not got a lot going on that's really compelling to me. Marlon Vera versus Corey Sandhagen is a super extreme matchup because you've got a high-volume guy versus a super low-volume guy who relies on big moments. And no matter how many of these play out, I think it's always the dumb decision to bet on the low-volume guy who relies on big moments because it's just at some point he's going to get so in a hole that he can't pull out of it. And it's especially because he's so inactive in his moments when he's not doing big bombs and timing things well, that when you meet a fighter who actually can exploit that properly, that's going to be really problematic. And I think Corey Sandhagen's exactly the sort of guy who will exploit that properly, because where Rob Font will pepper you with 40 punches while you're covering up, he's not a great body hitter. He's not a huge banger. He's not looking for elbows and things. Corey Sandhagen is going to be hitting the body. He's going to be kicking. He's going to be slicing Vera up with elbows and actually making it count the time that he's on offense. Add to that Corey Sandhagen's willingness to grapple when it is a good idea to grapple. If you take Marlon Vera down, if you land a opportunistic takedown on Marlon Vera, he will stay on the bottom throwing up triangles. Just terrible, terrible fight thinking. Just dumb stuff. And, you know, that's the sort of stuff that if Corey Sandhagen ever does find himself in trouble, he'll do that. He'll probably do it when he doesn't find himself in trouble, just to take a little breather. The volume really compels me because Sandhagen will do things like pump out a double jab or a right straight and then step through with the right jab to land a left body kick and things like that. You know, he looks for big connections on the body, and when he can't hurt people with blows to the head like he did against Song Yudong, he goes, okay, I'm going to elbow him and cut him up, which not only won him the fight with a damaged orbital, but it also made his job easier because if you cut a guy or if you swell up his eye, he's going to be able to see less and you can keep hitting him more. Marlon Vera, when he works, is really compelling to watch. You know, when he does cut the ring and he walks a guy into a wheel kick or a left hook, or when he does cover up and then he catches the collar tie and hits the guy with two elbows coming out, that's really compelling stuff. But he doesn't, you know, if he were doing that all the time, he'd be incredible. But he doesn't. He just sits back and does nothing for huge portions of the round. And if he does that, Corey Sandhagen is probably going to give him a horrible time. And the crazy thing is that Marlon Vera could do that and still win. And then I'm left with, like, you know, it's the anti-science of fighting. What am I left with? You know, you've got to keep betting against him when he meets guys who understand how to put together volume and win rounds. Even Aldo, not a huge volume fighter, but wins rounds. And keeps himself safe. Your co-main event is Holly Holm versus, Yana Kunitskaya, Yana Santos. Do be ready for a tedious slog along the fence in this one, because Holly likes to push people to the fence and knee their thighs, and Yana Kunitskaya, her best move is getting double underhooks along the fence, posting her head and kneeing the body. Yana Kunitskaya, not a great striker out in the open. Holly Holm likes to ish-ish and circle off. Actual fight of the night, Nate Landwehr versus Austin Lingo. Lingo's good, but Nate Landwehr is just on a great run. He's looked fantastic. I love his pressure. I love that he's learned the Muslim Salikov shoulder feint, then step back. If you put that on a pressure-fighting game, it becomes really annoying because the guy keeps thinking you've got to step in, so he keeps selling out on big swings to counter you stepping in and then missing, and then you step in the wake of them. Alex Perez versus Manel Cape is interesting, mainly because Alex Perez has had the weirdest career path in MMA. Went from headlining a pay-per-view to just being some guy with 7 cancelled fights and losing in the first round in his only fight back after that title shot. Pretty much just trying to give Manel Cape a win and get into title contention. Chidi Njikani versus Albert Duraev is two complete opposites of style. Duraev, if he gets him down, is going to do nothing. He's going to hammer fist his face and not really do any damage. Chidi Njikani, I hope he elbows him in the clinch. I really do. Anything else on this card? Trevin Giles is sometimes interesting because he's got that weird side-on style. CJ Vergara had a good one against Clayton Rodriguez, but then got murked by Tetsuro Taira. But he's fun. He's game. He's hard-nosed, which is not something that really gets you very far at flyweight typically, but, you know, good on him. And that's about it. Oh, we were supposed to have Nate Landwehr versus Alex Caceres. That would have been fun. But yes, it's not a great card. I'll talk about it afterwards and hope it's decent. One, again, is not an amazing card, especially after Rod Tang versus Superlek falls through. Superlek's fighting someone, don't know who. Alicia Rodriguez is fighting Janet Todd. You know, that could be fun. Well, they're giving Tammy Musumeci a grappling match, I presume as a favour to Mikey. Yeah, that's about it, you know. I just wanted to talk about the fun fights that I watched this week, not the ones that I'm not super stoked for this weekend, but I hope they're decent. You know, I wasn't expecting huge things out of Lerone Murphy versus whoever it was, but it delivered. You know where to find all my shit. You're my boy. I'm your boy, Jack Slack. And I'll catch you on Monday. Jason Perillo begging Marlon Vera to do something in the corner. Bless.